last time that I was talking, I was speaking about a certain passage in the Heart Sutra. And I don't know if you remember this particular passage, but I actually want to come back to it and speak about it a bit more. So this is a translation of the Heart Sutra done by Stephen Batchelor, and the commentary on it is from someone called Geshe Rabten, who died actually in the 1980s, but he was really a great teacher, and he was understood, or the Tibetans said that he had perceived emptiness directly, that he didn't just understand it intellectually, that he'd had the direct experience of intuitively or non-cognitively experiencing the empty nature of phenomena, which is a rarity and a great achievement. And if you read through his commentary in this book called Echoes of Voidness, there's not a wasted word. Mm-hmm. You know how sometimes you read things by people and it's kind of like there's a lot of chatting going on around the subject because there's a little bit of unclarity perhaps. But there's none of that in his commentary. So the passage that that I wanted to comment on is actually the 30th line in the Heart Sutra. The 29th and the 30th. And I'm just going to read the section to you, and then I want to read his commentary and talk about his commentary. This being the case, Shariputra, so it's Avalokiteshvara speaking. This being the case, Shariputra, in terms of voidness, there exist no forms, no feelings, no discernments, no formative elements, no consciousness. So those are the five skandhas that I've talked about so much in the last 5 years. Then he goes on and he says, no consciousness, as I finished saying, and then no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no bodies, no minds, no visual forms, no sounds, no smells, no tastes, no tactile sensations, no mental objects. There exist no visual elements, no mental elements, and no elements of mental consciousness. And he goes on like this in the sutra. And as I pointed out the last time we met, obviously Avalokiteshvara is not saying that there are no ears, because Shariputra is listening to him. They're having a conversation, you know. And there obviously are eyes because they're looking at each other, and there obviously are sounds that are to be heard. What's happening here is that Buddhists understand the basis of experience in terms of there being six senses, and that's where things get really interesting for Buddhism. There are the five senses that we're all familiar with, but then there's the sixth sense, which becomes a little hard to talk about. So the schema that they start with is that when we experience vision, there's what's called a form, which is a visual object, something that's out there that we know is reflecting light. And there's a consciousness, an awareness, and then the eyes, the physical organs. And when those three come together, we experience sight. If any one of those three is absent, sight doesn't happen. If you lie down and close your eyes, effectively there's no eye, as it were, and so there's no seeing. And we can understand that because we can close our eyes. And we sort of understand how that works from the point of view of taste, because if we're not eating anything, we don't generally taste anything. So we can understand if there's no object, there's no taste experience. But for sound, we can't really do that. We can't make sound go away. Too bad, or maybe not too bad, I don't know how to say this, but I have a very bad case of tinnitus. And what tinnitus apparently is about is that actually the ear organ is degenerating, and the brain wants to hear sounds that the ear can no longer transmit. So it replaces those sounds with a hissing noise, and that's what tinnitus is. So I was about to say it would be kind of nice if we could turn off sound and have real silence, but maybe it's not so nice, because when we turn off sound, what happens is we get another kind of noise, I'm not sure that there's an analogy for vision. But anyway, so this is where the analysis of how all kinds of cognition and cognitive experience works begins in Buddhism. And you know it's important because the Buddhist view is that everybody wants to be happy, nobody wants to be unhappy, and the reason we have unhappy experiences rather than happy experiences has to do with what our mind is doing, what our mind is about, and the habits and the history associated with the mental process and the consequences of that. So the whole Buddhist path is about dealing with that. So this is not news to anybody here, but I just wanted to review all of that. So now let me read this passage from Geshe Rabten's book. And this is on page 31. And remember, last time we met, I was very specific about making a distinction, a way of understanding the difference between the word mind and the word consciousness, because we in English tend to be a little bit sloppy about that. And so for mind, I defined mind as that which happens when consciousness, the mind organ, whatever that is, which is what I'll be talking about tonight, and the objects of mind come together. Objects of mind are thoughts, emotions, feelings, memories, all that kind of inner cognitive, subjective stuff. So those are like the objects of the mind organ. And when those and the mind organ and consciousness come together, we actually have what I would call mind. And as I recall, that's consistent with the way the word mind is used in this passage. So I wanted to be specific about that. And in this Heart Sutra, when the sutra says no mind, it doesn't mean that there is a non-existence of mind in an absolute sense. It means that mind is empty of something. Mind is empty of our ideas about mind as being solid, independent, and having its own nature apart from our ideas about what that is, which is kind of interesting when you apply it to mind. But anyhow, now let me read the passage with that prologue. He's talking about independent existence, and he starts the passage this way. The mind, too, has no independent existence. Any one state of mind depends upon numerous moments of consciousness and various mental factors. A mind that has been meditating for an hour appears to have an independent self-identity. But upon analysis, it is found to be utterly dependent upon the various individual thoughts, perceptions, and feelings that occurred during the hour, as well as upon the objects the mind was contemplating. The individual mental factors, for example, feelings of pleasure and pain, are also dependent upon a variety of conditions that, once assembled, cause a particular feeling to occur. The beginningless and endless stream of consciousness that passes from one life to another and finally reaches Buddhahood is not independently existent either. It is in a constant state of momentary change and thus depends upon the infinite number of moments that constitute its continuity. There's an awful lot that's packed into that passage. And one of the reasons that I focused on that passage was in the talk I did 2 weeks ago. One of the things I said was that just as there is an eye organ, which is the physical basis for seeing along with the objects, and there is an ear or ear organ, which is the physical basis for hearing sound, I said the ancient peoples didn't know what the brain did. And probably the brain was like, the brain probably was to mental experience like the eye and the ear are to hearing and seeing. So I don't know what the Buddhists would say about that. I mean, the reason I made that comment was partly because there were some folks who were here that were new, and I was trying to sort of open up this way of thinking for them, but partly because it might be true. I don't really know whether it's true or not. But the thing is that traditionally in Buddhism, it's said that each moment of consciousness in mental experience is not just dependent upon the previous moment of consciousness, as Geshe Rabten has said, but that the organ equivalent to the ear, the organ equivalent to the eye in regards to thought, is the previous moment of consciousness. Okay? That's a very difficult concept to grasp, how that would work. So I've been trying to wrap my understanding around that for 25 or 35 or 40 years or something like that, and I'm not sure that I've actually succeeded in doing that. But, you know, it's a very important distinction to say that the organ basis of mental experience or mentation or cognition, that the organ experience, excuse me, the organ basis, very different to say the organ basis of mental experience is the previous moment of consciousness rather than to say it's the brain. Now, there might be a way in which it could be both. It's not really impossible because the Dalai Lama has talked about consciousness as being of subtler characteristics and coarser characteristics. And he said that what we experience as mental consciousness is, in fact, dependent on the body. And it's coarser because it relates to sense organ experiences and that sort of thing. So mental consciousness, mind, mental consciousness as in the object, such as thought, the previous moment of consciousness, or the brain, whichever you like, and pure consciousness, those three coming together, however you want to understand them, is of a coarse nature and influenced by the senses. But consciousness is a little bit like an onion, if you'll pardon the expression. It has subtler and subtler dimensions to itself, which are within it or above it, or the source of it. That kind of metaphor doesn't hold because physicality doesn't really relate to consciousness, but our minds want a metaphor, so I'll use one of those. And he said that the subtlest or subtler forms of consciousness are not dependent on physical sense organ experience. The coarse versions of consciousness, of mental consciousness, are. But the subtle versions are not. And that's really very important because if we believe that there's only the coarse version of mentation or cognition or mental consciousness, then the logical conclusion is when the body dies, that stops and there isn't anything else. And Buddhists would agree with that on the coarse level, but they would disagree with it on the subtle level, because they would not assert that subtle consciousness is dependent upon the physical. They would say subtle consciousness is dependent upon the previous moment of subtle consciousness. And that's why this distinction about is the basis of cognition the brain or not is so important. So I oversimplified 2 weeks ago because I thought that that was useful to do in that context. But I didn't want to leave things that way. And I wanted to come back to this theme because, as Geshe Rabten says, each moment of consciousness, and they understand consciousness as being comprised of moments, and I'll talk about that, each moment of consciousness depends upon the previous moment of consciousness, and that there's a continuity which is beginningless and endless. So that's really metaphysical, and it's really hard to accept on faith. But on the other hand, If you think about what meditation experience is about, so we'll be doing a silent meditation later. If you think about what meditation experience is about, and you look at your own experience as you practice meditation over the years, I think you'll find, as I've found, that the coarse parts of consciousness which kind of entrap us when we begin the process are something that we can step beyond a bit as time goes on, and we start seeing that there are subtler elements to consciousness. And so we can understand that on that basis, maybe we can extrapolate that there could be even subtler elements of consciousness which are less dependent on the physical. You know, I think we can extrapolate that. I mean, that's what I've done in my own practice, is to look at that and say, you know, sometimes I can get into a very deep state of meditation, and what's going on in the physical world and kind of happening through my senses is not really having much of an impact on my state of mind, to use that language, or my consciousness. So I can ask, is it true, you know, that they're subtler still and subtler still? Well, as a matter of faith, of course, I want to believe that that's true. Because, well, I'm 68, and, you know, I think a lot about my mortality. It's like, in some respects, the idea that all of this is going to be over with is actually okay. But in other respects, it's not. I mean, I'm not exactly sure that I want to be around for eco-catastrophe, to be honest. And I would kind of prefer to think that, you know, when it's over, it's over. But actually, I don't think that that's the case. You know, I think we have a lot of complicated transitions ahead as human beings, and that we get to experience those things in some way. Some part of me would rather not, but I don't think that that's the way it's going to be. But who knows? Because there are many worlds, too, according to the Buddhists. And who knows what world I'll be on at any particular time in the future, or have been on at any particular time in the past. But of course, then again, that becomes a matter of faith. In the 90s, in the late 90s, we had a visit at our home in San Francisco from a lama who was head of the Gelugpa order of Tibetan Buddhism. And he was actually a very extraordinary person. We didn't know how extraordinary he was until he stayed in our house for a couple of days and we spent some time around him. Several years later, he died. And the Dalai Lama says, as an aside, curious aside, in his teaching on Mahamudra, which is a certain meditation practice, which he did in, the teaching was in Atlanta, in the spring of 2013, he said that when this lama died, he entered the clear light state for 18 days before his body dropped. And what, you know, when you die, various fluids come out of your body because the muscles release and whatnot. And presumably, when the heart stops and the breathing stops, you're dead, and that's going to happen. And the signs are pretty much there pretty quickly. The sphincters release and all that kind of stuff happens. Well, they say that if you're an accomplished meditator, you can meditate in such a way that the subtle moments of consciousness are aware of the subtle moments of consciousness, mm-hmm. that the continuity is aware of the continuity. Mm-hmm. And if the body is not seriously ravaged by illness, then it's possible to enter that state of meditation. And according to His Holiness, this lama spent 18 days in the clear light state. So I haven't spent 18 nanoseconds in the clear light state, as far as I'm aware of. He spent 18 days. So, you know, is it a matter of faith or not? I mean, what's going on? But I mean, it's the evidence attests to something unusual going on. He didn't make it up that there was this person sitting there for 18 days with no heartbeat, no mental activity, no breathing, but no other physical signs. So the point is that this matter of the moments of consciousness existing in a sequence and being able to be aware of each other apart from the coarse nature of consciousness is really important. It's really important to Buddhist thought, and if you're committed to this path, it's important to take this into account, because it really speaks to what the goal of practice is in a very profound way. So, you know, it's perhaps not appropriate for me to say probably none of us are going to have an experience like that, because I don't know who's sitting here with me, so I shouldn't be saying things like that. We don't know what our capacities are, and we all have capacities that we haven't really explored and haven't really cultivated. When His Holiness was in Portland in the spring of 13, yeah, probably just before he went to Atlanta, or maybe it was after he was in Atlanta, I don't know which it was. Do you remember when he was on stage at the very end? Mm-hmm. He said he was walking away, and everyone was kind of like, oh, he's leaving. We're all holding our scarves and feeling, well, that was really wonderful. Probably all 14,000 people in the auditorium having the same thought. He did something spontaneous. He stopped, and he turned around, and he went back to the microphone, and he looked out at the entire auditorium, and I think he actually held his finger up like this, mm-hmm, and he said, I'm no different than you are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. We all have this, mm-hmm, capacity, mm-hmm, and I've cultivated it. Mm-hmm. You should do the same thing. That's the only difference between us. I have, mm-hmm, and you haven't. Or maybe he didn't say you haven't, but anyhow, yeah, he said, I have, and you can, and you should.
Mm-hmm. He said we have the same potential.
Yeah.
Potential.
Yeah.
Potential.
Potential.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And
that's the potential he's talking about is what I'm talking about here. Mm-hmm. We have the potential to enter into these deep states of consciousness. We have these potentials to understand how the mind works. And in understanding how the mind works, and understanding how these moments of mind function, and how cognition functions, and how senses influence cognition, and how memory influences cognition, and how passions, desires, and aversions influence, mm-hmm, cognition. All those things shape how we are in relationship to each other and how we are in relationship to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And all of those things can be changed. Every single one of those can be changed for the better, whatever we think the better is. It's really hard to remember that, but it's there. A lot of times I find myself thinking a lot about emptiness, shunyata, as Buddhists talk about it, which is, in a certain sense, everything being dependent upon everything else, which sounds okay, but I tend to be a glass half empty kind of guy. So I tend to look at that as things are falling apart and they're getting worse. And, you know, in 2014 in the United States, it's not too hard to do that, right? If you're reading the papers and, yeah, you know, pay attention to economics and politics and what's going on with your neighbors and all that kind of stuff, it's not too hard to come to that conclusion. But the glass is also half full. And the thing about everything being interdependent and everything changing is everything can change for the better, too. There's no fundamental reason why it can't. As my friend in Portland, who I saw yesterday, said, and this is my oldest friend from college, he said, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world that doesn't look so good, but also all of it is an opportunity to learn and change, and at other levels, there are profound opportunities. Mm-hmm. And he's right. Mm-hmm. There are profound opportunities in the midst of all of this, I mean, in terms of our own practice, and in terms of our understanding and change and sharing those things. And That's what Buddhism is really all about, as far as I'm concerned. So as a almost lifelong practitioner, Kay tells me that I've changed a lot in the almost 30 years she's known me. So I have to take that for granted because I can't really see it. All I can see is me in relationship to the me of 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. And my memory is now of such a nature that I'm not sure that I can remember the me of 10 minutes ago, let alone certainly 25 or 30 years ago. But the other thing, though, is even apart from any change that we might or might not be able to create, for myself, it seems to me that if I can't dip into a place of deep peace on a regular basis, I just could not survive from day to day. I don't know if Robin Williams' suicide had any impact on you or not. It did on a lot of people, you know. And here's a man of extraordinary talent and humanity and achievement who reached a place where he just felt like he couldn't go on. And I kind of wonder if that's because he didn't have that place to go to within himself that I'm talking about. But I don't know him. I never met him. I don't know anything about him. But when you think about events like that, you know, I think that I feel grateful that every once in a while I can get to that place and that I had teachers mm-hmm. and a community to assist me to, you know, dip into that to the extent that I can every once in a while and depend on that. And all good things come out of it. I don't want to end this talk on a sour note. All good things come out of it because as one of my teachers, Swami Rudrananda said, when you practice, the best thing is to go to the source. So Swami Rudrananda, also called Rudy, was an incredibly successful antiques dealer in New York who died in an airplane crash in the mid-70s. And I had the good fortune to live with him for a while, be one of his students. And he was a very pragmatic, down-to-earth kind of person, and he was a Jewish boy from Brooklyn. So he said, the thing about going to the source for all of your spiritual practice is you only pay one price once, and everything comes out of that. Go for wholesale. Don't go for retail. Go to the source. So I think that's a good place to end it. Go to the source. Yeah.